Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Most people around the world like to eat meat. It's a fact of life. But that means we're now devouring the bounty of the oceans, tearing down forests to make pastures, and polluting land, river, and sea with farm runoff. Some folks opt to go vegan or eat insects. But now Silicon Valley is investing in an option straight out of sci-fi. They're making fake meat and fake fish, chicken, and duck in a lab. This hour on Point, science and what's for dinner. You can join us on air or online. What do you say? Hallelujah? All the meat you can eat and it doesn't hurt the planet? Or does this sound like Frankenfood? Would you be willing to try tube steak? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Tara Duggan. She's a cookbook author and food reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, and she's done extensive reporting on the big money in faux meat. Tara, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. So let's start at the beginning. What exactly is fake meat?
Well, we actually, I co-authored this with one of my coworkers, Jonathan Kaufman, and we looked at three different categories of fake meat. We looked at plant-based, which are made out of plant products. We looked at what's called cellular agriculture. It's, like you said, created in a lab out of stem cells. And then there's also a whole other category that's a little complicated to explain that is often called yeast-based fermentation, which creates animal proteins through fermentation.
And what we're talking about is not a lab that grows an actual chicken, for example, but you'd walk into a lab and see what, lots of chicken patties lying there, lots of chicken breasts made from cell cultures?
I think it's important to clarify that, because especially when people say things like Frankenfood, they think of, you know, some kind of chicken with fish fins. So it's actually creating the meat, the muscle and fat that is in the meat. So it's just creating the actual product that you eat. It doesn't create all of the extra parts of the animal.
Okay. Why are people doing this?
Well, that's what's so interesting to look at, because this is really looking, this industry seems to be very much looking forward in the next 5 or 10 years in terms of when things will actually be on the market and how the market is changing. So really, like you pointed out at the beginning, we're looking at some resources that are declining worldwide in terms of how much meat production we can actually do on a global scale. At the same time, the population is due to reach, 9.7 billion by 2050. And at the same time, the demand for meat continues to rise. So there's this sense of we need to find a way to create this, to solve for this demand for meat without using so many resources.
Now, a lot of the funding for this is coming from Silicon Valley. Who is investing in this?
There are some, it's a lot of the big names in Silicon Valley. Bill Gates was involved with Impossible Foods. We've got some of the big names in some of the large technology companies have made some kind of very public investments, but there are also some interesting incubators. Like there's one called IndieBio right in San Francisco that has funded a lot of the companies that we covered in our piece about the future of meat. So there's also actually some investment coming from big food companies like Tyson. Tyson has a $150 million investment fund that it's using to work on a few of these newer technologies. So it's interesting to see that as well, because there's a sense of some real opportunity in the future.
So this is not some future fantasy. I want to be clear that some of this is happening right now. In fact, here is an interview the journalist Laura Ling did after she ate meatless shrimp or I guess you might call it shrimpless shrimp, from a biotech firm called New Wave Foods. Listen to this.
I think it's yummy. You can tell it's not real shrimp?
No, I can't. Tastes a little like scallop.
Oh, okay. So did it meet the Doug Ling seafood loving test?
Very nice.
So this exists. Tara, have you tried some of this meatless meat? And how is it?
Yes, actually, I tried the shrimp that they were just talking about, the New Wave Foods. And when I tried it, I thought it was a little on the dry side, but I did think the flavor was great. And it really, really does look like shrimp. I think they're working out the formula for that. It's coming onto the market very soon, though. It's a plant-based shrimp product. The idea is that it has no allergens. You know, a lot of people are allergic to shellfish. It's actually kosher because it's all plant-based, so you could serve it at a kosher bar mitzvah. It's got a lot of attributes that could make it very popular. There's also the newish Impossible Burger, which is the burger that bleeds. That's also a plant-based meat product.
Wait, so they added meat. Fake blood?
That's kind of the tagline for that product. They use a product called heme, which is found in both meat and plants. It creates that sort of iron flavor in meat, and it also creates a red color that looks like meat. The idea with that is really to appeal to a broader audience. I don't think a lot of vegetarians will want to eat a burger that looks bloody. But the idea really is to reach a mainstream audience, and that's where they see the market going.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to bring in another voice. This is Brian Wyrus. And Brian, who's coming in from San Francisco, is one of the pioneers of the future meat industry. He's co-founder of Finless Foods, an early-stage biotech company that's growing fish meat from real fish stem cells. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And did I get that right? You're making fake fish out of real fish cells.
Correct. So I like using the term cultured meat. Basically, we take a small harmless biopsy from thousands of different kinds of fish, and we grow that into millions of tons to be introduced back into the marketplace and feed the ever-growing population.
So first of all, have you eaten it? What does it taste like? Or are you not there yet?
Not there just quite. By September, I hope to have a product. Prototype, so to speak.
What made you get into this? Are you concerned about environmental impacts, or do you see this as a way to get filthy rich?
No, that's a very good question. The ocean's ecosystems are crumbling right before our eyes, and most of that is due to overfishing, and this is a way to perturb that heavy load onto basically the ocean's ecosystem. This is unsustainable. This is not what we can continue to do for the next couple of years, and I think that this is the natural next step.
Is there a day you discovered it occurred to you you could grow your own fish? How do you make that leap?
So basically, I reconnected with an old friend, Mike Selden, the CEO of Finless Foods. And he was actually teaching science in Taiwan. He came back to New York City. I was working there at Weill Cornell Medical College on 69th in York. And we just went for a beer, talked about it in the bar, and he kind of approached me with this crazy idea to make a fish company with no fish. And I was like, oh, this is crazy. It's impossible. And we just started writing on the back of a bar napkin, and that turned into an Excel sheet, and that turned into a Slack channel, and that turned into a pitch that later granted us acceptance to IndieBio, the largest biotech accelerator in the world.
And can you tell us how much your company is valued at, or how much the value of this business in general is?
The value of the business is in, I would say, in the couple hundred billions, in that range. As of right now, I think a number was quoted to me as 3.1 million, something around that.
Wow. So I'm surprised to read you the following. We've gotten some listener feedback already online, and it's overwhelmingly positive. Grant Cook says, if you had a protein that tasted good, texture, taste, aroma, appearance, curability, smokeability, ability to make a pan sauce, I'd give it a try. Steve McNutt says, if it's a protein, if it's safe, sure. What we eat is a largely learned cultural preference, and if this is a bridge to a more sustainable future, it's one worth exploring. Is that the kind of reaction you overwhelmingly encounter, Tara? Or do you, may I ask you, do you find people who are a little bit more skeptical that this is a sci-fi nightmare?
Definitely get reactions all over the board. Coming from the Bay Area, one thing that's very interesting is in Northern California, Bay Area, we have such a strong ethic of local farming and natural organic farming. So there is, especially in our area, reaction. Why can't you just raise cows in a more sustainable way? Why can't you just eat vegetables instead of making these, you know, faux products? So it's a big range. You know, we have a lot of people who are really interested in seeing technology as a solution. So they're more interested in new ideas. I've seen actually quite a, I'm glad to hear there's a mix of reactions, because I've seen a lot of resistance actually.
Brian, you must get some resistance. If you could answer this quickly, this is genetically modified food. I mean, it's genetically created food.
So I'm actually not touching the genome at all. So you could actually label this as non-GMO.
Huh.
So basically, I would argue, as far as health risks, what do you really think that you're eating on your dinner plate table? It's full of mercury and heavy metals, and I think that this would be actually a healthier alternative.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about faux meat and a future without slaughterhouses or factory farms. Sounds good? Well, you just have to be willing to eat meat grown in the lab. You can join our conversation. Are you already eating this way or almost this way? Would you be more open to it if it tasted just like the real thing? My guests are Tara Duggan, cookbook author and a food reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, Brian Wyrus, co-founder of the biotech startup Finless Foods. And now I'd like to bring in Kale Walsh, co-owner of the Herbivorous Butcher, a vegan butcher shop in Minneapolis. Kale, welcome to On Point.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me.
So I got to start. Is Kale your real name or did you choose that because you're a vegan?
You know, I was born Beef Testosterone Walsh, but I had to change it. It just wouldn't work. No, I was named after my grandma, Keela. That's just how it happened.
It's meant to be. So you call yourself a vegan butcher. What does a vegan butcher sell?
So if you walk into our shop, we've got a meat case full of 40 different all-vegan meats, 20 different cheeses on rotation, and we make new stuff every week, so it's a lot of fun for us.
But What, for example, do you make ribs, you make charcuterie out of vegetable protein? Is that how it works?
Yeah. So a lot of our products are a wheat base, like a seitan. And with that base, you can make anything from Italian sausages to ribs to ribeye steaks. And we even marble the fat in by hand to simulate the quote-unquote real thing. Just none of the, you know, factory farming or any of that, so.
So unlike the guests we were talking to earlier, you're not tinkering with science. You're a chef cooking with existing vegetable protein ingredients to make meat-like products. Is that correct?
That is correct. My sister and I started the vegan butcher shop in the first place because we were sort of skeptical of you know, all these things and all these chemicals being put into the food we were eating. We wanted to make food that we could eat out of, you know, ingredients we could pronounce and put our hands on at the, you know, local co-op grocery store. You know, simple things like that.
And so you launched a Kickstarter campaign and sold it to
the world. Oh, we did. Yeah. After a few years in the farmer's market, we launched a Kickstarter, had help from a local investor, and started our shop. Now we're hoping to have more within the next few years.
Okay, Kale, you were kind enough to send ahead some of your meat products, your meals. So I am sitting with them in front of me in the studio in Boston, and I'm going to dig in, do the thing my mom told me not to do, which is talk while I'm eating. And would you explain to everybody what I'm eating? I'm having Korean barbecued ribs. They look like the real thing with sesame seeds on top, but what's in them?
Sure. So, like I said earlier, it's a wheat base, very high protein wheat flour. From there, we add things like apple juice, sesame oil, things like that.
Oh, they're flavorful.
Yeah, and it's all in the in the cooking method. So we braise them to get kind of that good char flavor. Then we bake them in our own Korean barbecue sauce. Yeah.
Sort of sweet. It doesn't have the same texture as traditional ribs. Not the stringy, you know, I don't know what to say without grossing people out, but
sure.
It tastes like a patty more than a piece of meat.
Yeah, we do the best we can with the things we have. But,
okay, and here's some pastrami. It looked very bacon-like. Let me see. What's in the pastrami?
So the pastrami is also a wheat base. We add a myriad of different spices and herbs, fennel.
I like that.
Oregano, things like that. A lot of tomato juice, tomato paste.
That's why it's so red.
It's
very red pastrami.
Yep. Also, red beet powder helps with the color.
Not your New York deli typical thing.
Sure. No.
And the bread, is the bread somehow specially engineered too?
The bread is lab grown. No, I'm just kidding. That's just bread.
That's just bread. Okay, and chicken with duck sauce. Is this your signature dish, or
chicken
what's
with
this?
Duck sauce. I don't think that one's ours.
Oh no, it's definitely yours. We must have mislabeled it. It's.
Oh, the chicken might be ours.
It's chicken. It's not chicken, but it's called chicken.
True. Yeah.
I think. My favorite is probably pastrami because it tastes the most, it's sort of salty, and maybe that helps make it taste like the traditional thing.
Sure.
It's the sauces. Is that what really does the trick?
I mean, sauces definitely help. We try to give people a blank canvas on which, you know, they can paint any sort of flavor. So you could do lemon chicken, sesame chicken, whatever you want with it.
Now, the folks who come into your shop to buy this meat, are they mostly vegans?
Since our days at the farmer's market, they've been mostly omnivores,
really?
You know, looking to do a meatless Monday or something like that. Or they've got a vegan son or daughter coming back from college that they want to impress, something like that.
And are you doing this do you want to convert more vegans in the process? Or is this really about just providing an alternative and let people live as they will?
You know, we exist to bridge a gap. Between omnivores and vegans, you know, there's a lot of misconception over you know, veganism, that it's all just eating, you know, twigs and things you find outside. That's what I thought. You know, I haven't been vegan forever. And when I started making this stuff, I realized that it's possible, and we want to provide that option to as many people as we can without any risk to their health.
Great. Let's take it to the callers and hear what people are thinking of this new meat-free future. Todd is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Todd, what's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. Yes, I'm a big proponent of the meatless meat, or what I would say the plant-based meat. Myself, I do that. I do the seitan. I have the beef patties that are from seeds, from wheat, from soy. So, and I'll tell you, the way I got into it is I had a prostate cancer scare a few years ago, did some research, and they told me when I did it, looking at it, they said, get rid of it. And I was like, what are they talking about? They said, change your diet. Get away from dairy. And that included milk, cheese, meat, everything. Just get rid of it. And it wasn't for sure that I had it, but I had the precursors to it. I had things that were telling me my PSA was at 7.5, which I know that is.
And you had to change your diet. I love it.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to move on now. Thank you, Todd. Brenda is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, what do you think of meatless meat?
Hi, Jessica. I am all for it. If we humans cannot figure out how to feed ourselves without visiting cruelty on other species, and destroying everything around us, then we don't deserve to be here. Now, I want to be truthful. I'm low income, so I cannot afford the meat substitutes. So I mostly eat eggs and greens and vegetables and nuts.
Thank you, Brenda. I suspect that in time the price of these things will come down. We'll talk to our panel about that. But first, let's go to James, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. James, what's your take?
Hi, Jessica. Yeah, I think it's great. I'm all about the sci-fi. I'm a bio major. But I think there's probably some concerns about, you know, I think everyone's afraid of, like, where does the food come from? McDonald's. And I think some people are afraid that these giant corporations are going to get their hands on them, and they might tweak it, and they might and that might not be as legit as Brian is saying it is. And also, you have to combat just the social stigma. I mean, our culture, I mean, we don't like to change when it comes to, like, these specific things. And I think it'll be a very tough battle. I'm all for it. And I think Whole Foods is going to fight like no other to say that these are genetically modified. And when it's not, they're going to say whatever they can to get people to not go for it and go for their organically raised produce.
Well, let's take that to the panel, and I'm sure it's going to be not one company, but a whole slew of businesses out there that could react to this. Tara, first of all, are you surprised by the positive response we're getting, and so far no skeptics?
I am surprised, to be honest, because we did get I've heard a lot of skepticism. I do think that it's an interesting point about you know, pushback from the industry on different angles. Actually, Whole Foods does carry one of the products we've written a lot about, which is Beyond Meat, which is a plant-based burger, similar probably to what Kale is doing, more on that end of the, you know, it's made out of plant-based ingredients like wheat and pea protein. But it's just so all over the board. I think people are very concerned about that example of who has control of
right.
their food. And I think that's one of the big issues.
Well, Brian, let me ask Brian quickly. Manufacturing, culturing this fish. I don't know how you describe this future. Do you foresee a day in which major agribusinesses and major food companies are mass distributing your lab-grown fish?
Yes, I do. Currently, what they're doing is fishing for a specific type of fish, and you could see the population just plummet right after they offer a certain kind of fish fillet on their menu. Then governments react. They put up certain safe harbors. They put up restrictions. And all they do is just move on to the next fish. This is called serial depletion. Basically, using our technology, you could basically not have any influence on the ocean. Just for a simple biopsy that might take one or two fish and harmlessly take that biopsy and grow it out into millions of pounds of fresh food. So once the big giants do actually implement this technology, we'll see a bounce back in the ocean's ecosystem.
Kale,
and
let me ask Kale, are you concerned that in the future you see food giants producing our food in labs? It might be good for the fish in the oceans, but are you concerned about the impact on humans?
Yeah, you know, I appreciate the, you know, the benefit to the environment of, you know, a lab grown fish or something like that. But, you know, what concerns me is, you know, I don't know the health of a lab-grown fish if it still has cholesterol. I assume it does since it's still, you know, an animal cell. And, you know, cholesterol is one of the major causes of diabetes and heart disease in our country and around the world. So, you know, I can see big companies like Tyson and McDonald's, you know, latching onto this and, you know, feeding the same thing to people. That's hurting them just as much. Given it's better for the environment, but it still does concern me, yeah.
Brian, your response to that?
Of course. So we will have complete control over this product. We can make it with less cholesterol. We can make it with more healthier fats, more antioxidants, more nutritious than actually what you're getting out of the ocean. So we could actually tailor make it to whatever health restrictions you would want. And on top of that, we would want a very close and open relationship with the FDA. Basically, what kinds of experiments do we have to do to gain the favor of the FDA or any other regulatory body? We want to be as open and as transparent as possible, and also specifically to our consumers. We want to hear their comments, questions, concerns, or even support. We want to engage in conversation
talk
about this.
We have a caller with some concerns. Let's listen to John, who's calling in from Tulsa, Oklahoma. John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so with stem cell lines that typically will come from a single source, without the genetic diversity that you would typically see in the natural world, how can we ensure that things like prion diseases won't be propagated into the food supply?
Thanks so much. Brian, do you have an answer to that? How do we ensure certain diseases aren't introduced to the food supply?
Of course. We could take multiple samples from multiple different of the same fish species. And on top of that, the quality control that will have to be implemented on this product would be of the highest standard. We would screen all of the products coming out from the factories and basically seeing if there is any propagation of any prion diseases. Again, it's being able to have the resolution down to the cellular level for us to see this is the most purest and cleanest protein source that you can ever imagine.
Tara, how far are we from the day when we can be sure that this is the cleanest, purest source with no disease?
That's a really good question. And one thing I do want to caution everyone on is, you know, this isn't going to replace traditional agriculture overnight. It's plant-based meat is still far less than 1% of the market in the U.S. meat market. So there's a long way to go before this production can ramp up. And one thing that we have looked into is the regulation aspect. And I was just chatting with Brian before we started. You know, the FDA doesn't even know what these products are yet. So they're going to have to basically create regulation as they're developed because they're so brand new. I have heard people bring up the issue of what about allergens? You know, is there potential that someone might be allergic because it hasn't been tested, you know, to this particular protein? But the proteins are based on the original animal protein. So it's really a question of how will that happen? How will testing happen? And I think we have quite a way to go. Like Brian said, he needs to have a prototype first to even work with the FDA.
Kale, I have a question that I've always wanted to ask vegan chefs. When I go to a vegan restaurant and they serve chicken patty artichoke hearts, I always wonder, why not just serve artichoke hearts? If you're trying to move away from meat, why try to describe it in terms of meat? Why not just let these products embrace their vegetableness?
Sure. Well, using terms that people are familiar with makes it easier for them to, I suppose, you know, look for the things they would find in the original protein, like the stringiness that an artichoke might bring, or things like that. So that's what we do at our shop. You know, we don't call our stuff, you know, BF with a BEAF, you know, like that. It's beef. Right. It's ground beef, you know. By using the words that people, you know and grew up with, it makes the transition a little bit easier.
But are you hoping for a day when we no longer need that, when describing things in terms of chicken or duck is outdated?
I definitely do, and I think it's coming. I think it's definitely coming. When you see companies like Tyson, you know, investing in plant-based foods, you know a change is coming. You know, when the big dogs are you know, trying to fund smaller companies.
When the big money's there, the future is here now.
That's true. We're getting there.
Our listeners are excited. One writes in, plant-based meat is the future, y'all. All right. Thanks so much for joining us, Kale Welsh, owner of the Herbivorous Butcher in Minneapolis. Kale, please enjoy. I'm going to enjoy your samples for the rest of the day.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at new efforts in Silicon Valley and beyond to solve the huge environmental problems that come with cattle farms, fish farms, ocean trawlers. You can join the conversation. Do you need to know more about how this fish and meat is made before you're willing to try it? Would you trust the government if they said it's safe to eat? And how would you feel if big food producers start replacing burgers with test tube ground meat? What's on your griddle for Memorial Day barbecue? My guests are Tara Duggan, cookbook author and a food reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, and Brian Wyrus, co-founder of the biotech startup Finless Foods. Also joining us now from Yonkers, New York, is Michael Hansen. He is a biologist, ecologist, and senior staff scientist at Consumers Union, which is the policy and action division of Consumer Reports. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me on.
So, boy, do I have a lot of questions for you. First of all, I just want to know, is this safe? Fish grown in a lab from real fish stem cells, do you think it will be healthy for humans to eat?
Well, I think the answer there is it depends what the inputs are. The way Brian has described it so far, it sounds like it could be fine. I mean, it will have to go through a regulatory process. But what I want to say is if you look at your three different types of food we're talking about here that Tara pointed out, plant-based, cellular agriculture, and yeast-based fermentation, it should be pointed out that the yeast-based fermentation, that all includes genetically engineering proteins or substances. With the plant-based, that can also include genetically engineering some of the ingredients that go in or not. Those should all be required to go through safety assessments because those could raise safety issues. But any new way of making a food, you would just want to make sure that it's safe, right? So as long as the kinds of things he's using for his cell culture system have all been approved and are fine for food, then that shouldn't be a problem for his fin-based stuff. And I do like how he has talked about wanting to be as open as possible with all the regulatory agencies. I think that's a very positive approach.
Brian, is there anything you want to say to that?
Basically, I basically agree with what you said. We want to be as open and as transparent as possible because we know that this is a new idea and it might be a little upsetting for some viewers or some people taking a look at the industry.
Great.
I think that it's the future.
Okay. Michael, let me ask you, though, do you have a beef with any aspect of this?
Well, there is a concern with some of these companies are using genetically engineered either yeast or bacteria to genetically engineer proteins, add them to foods, and those should be required to go through safety assessments. There's been one company, for example, that used an engineered protein, and they tried to say that it was grass, generally recognized as safe. They even submitted a letter to the FDA saying that they considered it grass and they wanted the FDA to look at it. And then a year later, they wrote back to the FDA and they asked them to stop looking at that and they withdrew that letter. Now, that product, I believe, is on the market now and it hasn't gone through a safety assessment. An engineered protein that is coming from the roots of a plant that hasn't been in the diet before does need to go through a safety assessment. So any of these plants or any of these foods that contain engineered ingredients, those should be required to go through safety assessments because that is a new technology and sometimes things can go wrong.
Are you saying that some of this food falls through the cracks because it's not technically
meat, it's not tested by the FDA, and there's
part of this is this larger problem with what's called GRAS, generally recognized as safe. That's the system that unfortunately allows companies to make their own decisions about what's safe and then to notify the FDA. When it was first came into being, which was when they made the food amendments back in the late 50s, they basically meant it to be, you know, foods that, and ingredients that had been are around for long periods of time in the food supply. But these new genetically engineered proteins are things that are new, and so they should be required to go through safety assessments. But companies can literally decide for themselves that these things are generally recognized as safe, and they don't necessarily have to tell the government. In this case, they did submit something to the government, but they stopped them from looking at it, which raises all sorts of questions, because usually you don't do that unless you think you might not get the answer
right.
You want from the FDA.
Sounds like maybe there was a problem. Let's take a call. Connie is calling in from Savannah, Georgia. Connie, what's your question?
Hi, everyone. My question is taking this kind of to a much broader level. I guess my question is particularly for Brian, but I'm glad Michael's there, too. Do these, I almost want to call them inventions, do you see these as having the potential for, say, mitigating large-scale famine on the global level?
Brian, why don't you address that?
That's a very good question. I see a future where it does. I see a future where this is a sustainable source of nutrition for all of the world, not only the super rich, but every single person on every single part of the world.
Tara, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think, you know, that's really the question here is, can this be done at an affordable and broad level? And that's really what we're looking at. And a lot of the entrepreneurs involved are saying that the cost will be much lower than traditional meat production.
So
and
it's
so that's really the question.
It's lower cost in theory. It's more readily, it's easier to disseminate. There's also the impact on the meatpacking industry. Working in a meatpacking factory is one of the most dangerous jobs out there. I want to listen for just one moment to a report from Harvest Public Media about the conditions workers in the meatpacking industry experience.
Some meatpacking workers reported making 40,000 to 100,000 motions every 8-hour shift. And they have to do it quickly. Some workers say they have to complete 150 motions per minute. That's why regulators say a common problem among meatpacking workers is musculoskeletal disorders, or MSDs, things like carpal tunnel syndrome, tendonitis, and rotator cuff injuries.
So that could be one of the issues that's not just addressed, but turned into ancient history if we move to a meatless future. But there are other concerns. I think Andy calling in from Binghamton, New York, has some to raise. Andy, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just wondered what it is that one is feeding to lab-grown fake meat, and what's the energy subsidy? One of the problems with eating real meat is that it's a very inefficient conversion of vegetable protein to meat protein. What are we talking about when we grow it in a lab?
Thanks so much, Andy. Brian, first of all, do you feed something to a lab-grown piece of meat?
Yes. Yes, you do. It's basically a couple of key proteins as well as compounds and a water-based media. And these are cells that are attached on a 2D surface on the bottom of a plate. And basically, it's like a swimming pool, and it's a constant fresh a constant stream of fresh media that basically rejuvenates these cells. It comes down to a couple proteins and a couple compounds.
And then what are the energy subsidies?
Glucose. Glucose is the main one. There are different ways of supplying energy to the system. As of right now, we're using plain old glucose, which is needed in these cells to survive.
Got it. Anything in there raise concerns for you, Michael?
Well, he didn't say what the proteins are. I just asked him, are you using any hormones or other things? What are the
Brian?
Key proteins? Because, you know, for fish, I do know that when you're talking about meat products, they might use some calf serum or other things, but that wouldn't be the case here with the fish. So as long as they're willing to identify the proteins and the other things that they're, you know, putting in, it may or may not be a problem. So it depends on what they are.
I guess, Brian, the question is, what are the proteins? Are there hormones in it? Can you ensure that there's no antibiotics that are transferred from those fish stem cells?
Of course. So basically, we're trying to recapitulate what's happening within the body of the fish. It basically lives in this microenvironment where it gets certain signals of hormones, of growth factors, of certain proteins that basically attach to receptors that create signals within the cell to change, to grow. This is happening within your body. This is happening within each animal body that you are feeding your guests with. This is just this natural combination of signals that is creating a final product.
Oh, I just had the craziest thought when you said that. To serve your guests this non-meat meat without telling them, somehow that would seem very unfair.
Well, yeah. I just want to say quickly, again, it depends on, yes, a number of these things are found naturally within the body, but hormones are actually very powerful things. So, for example, estrogen is found naturally in the body, found naturally for women, but slight tweakings of it or adding it from the outside can actually have potential health effects. So, again, it's going to depend on if you are using these hormone signaling things. I'm very well aware of receptors and how all this stuff works.
Correct.
They just have to be identified and looked and see if they're at the proper levels, et cetera, et cetera. That's all. And he said that he plans to have everything open and transparent, so that should be fine for the process.
Let's check in with Keith, who's calling from Boca Raton, Florida. Hi, Keith. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I got to the show late, so I'm wondering if maybe this wasn't already addressed, but can the panel speak to why we don't simply move from a meat-based diet to a 100% whole foods plant-based diet? The American Dietetic Association, World Health Organization, and other organizations have shown explicitly that humans can get all of the nutrition they need from plant-based sources. We don't have to create mock meats. We don't have to create lab meats. I know there's a lot of money in it, so that's a driving force. But, you know, if we believe that harming animals is wrong, then we live vegan. And if we understand that...
Okay, we're losing your call a bit, but we get the drift there. Tara, you want to address this? How does the industry respond to that? Why not just adjust our diet to plants and grains?
Well, I think it's interesting because a lot of the founders of these companies are actually vegans and vegetarians who already do that in their own personal life. And I think the real issue is that only about 3% of the population is vegetarian in the U.S. And although the number of vegans is, I think half of the vegans in the U.S. are millennials. So there is a sign of change that people will probably embrace more just plant-based eating. But if you look at what's really happening, 97% of the meat we eat is not organic, for example. So there's an appetite for meat that doesn't seem to be going away. And also when you look at, for example, China, the appetite for fish has increased over 100% in the last decade. So it's not just here.
I just want to get to one more call. Mike, who's calling in from Philadelphia. What's your concern, Mike?
Hi. So I'm a vegan and I eat a lot of plant-based protein substitutes. And I'm wondering about,
when you have something like lab-grown meat where there's so much more research and development required, and, you know, obviously this Silicon Valley capital, like venture capital, how difficult do you think that would be to kind of convert the carnivores, like true carnivores, you know what I mean?
Interesting. Okay. Tara, do you have a take on that? Do you think cow country is going to go for this?
Well, there are a lot of signs of people being open to it. I think one of the main issues that we've looked at a few surveys of, you know, people asking if this food was safe and it tastes exactly like or very close to the original product, would you try it? And there was a lot of openness to trying it. I think the really, really big issue that everyone acknowledges is it has to taste good. You can't just appeal to people's ethics or concerns about the environment. You really to really make it work, it has to taste good. And that's the bottom line, really.
Brian, do you see this eventually replacing your product, replacing fish? We'll no longer fish for fish.
I hope so. As of right now, there's no such thing as sustainable seafood. Stocks are going low. It's really a heavy hand in the ocean's ecosystem. And I really do think that this is the future of seafood.
Will we have to cook it differently?
No, not at all. The name of the game is to recapitulate everything you see right now on your dinner table. The texture, the consistency, the smell, the way it sizzles, everything has to be 100% the same. However, it comes from a different source.
Michael, let me ask. Go ahead.
I was just going to say one thing to point out, though, is that it will be more like a ground fish product at first, right? Just to point that out.
Yes, yes. At first, there will be a more like a surimi. However, eventually we will get into fillet design.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to wrap up our episode on faux fish and faux meat. Thanks to all of you, Brian Wyrus, co-founder of the biotech startup Finless Foods. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Hansen is a biologist and ecologist and senior staff scientist at Consumers Union, the policy and action division of Consumer Reports. Michael, thanks for checking the facts for us.
All right, thanks. You're welcome.
And Tara Duggan, cookbook author and food reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you for your big perspective and your long-distance view on this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up tomorrow, former top White House counterterrorism advisor Richard Clark joins us to talk Russia, cybersecurity threats, and more. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.